From Vermont Public Radio, this is The Frequency. I'm Henry Epp.
And I'm Liam Elder Connors. It's Tuesday, May 12th. Today on the podcast, could Vermont's farms feed all Vermonters?
It would only take 50,000 acres of potatoes to provide all the calories for the whole state of Vermont for the whole year.
More from the latest question tackled by Brave Little State coming up. First, today's headlines.
Retail stores will be allowed to resume in-person operations on May 18th. That's the latest announcement in Governor Phil Scott's plan to gradually reopen Vermont's economy. Employees will be required to wear masks, and everyone in a store will have to maintain a 6-foot distance from one another. Stores will be capped at 25% capacity at any given time, and customers will be encouraged but not mandated to wear masks in retail shops.
Scott says Vermont can keep reopening its economy because, for now, the state is finding few reported cases of COVID-19. On Monday, there were no new cases and no new deaths, according to the health department. 5 people remain hospitalized and 53 people have died in Vermont, while 785 are known to have recovered.
But even with the state's low case numbers of COVID-19, Health Commissioner Mark Levine is reminding Vermonters to wear a cloth mask in public. He says masks should be worn inside businesses and whenever you're around other people from outside your household.
Even if you're out alone in the open air, be ready to slip it on when you happen to be near others.
But Levine says there are some exceptions. Children under 2 and people who have trouble breathing should not wear masks.
Meanwhile, Vermont utility regulators have denied a New York developer's plan to build a large solar project in Bennington. It's been a long-running battle between some local homeowners and developer Thomas Malone. He's fought for 7 years to get his 2-megawatt project off the ground, but the Public Utility Commission has ruled the project, which would clear-cut 10 acres of land, violates the Bennington town plan.
The coronavirus pandemic has messed with the food supply chain here in Vermont and around the world, and that's gotten a lot more people interested in local food.
So if food shortages were to get bad enough, could Vermont farms feed the whole state? That's the question that VPR's people-powered journalism show Brave Little State answers in their latest episode. Host Angela Evans is here to share an excerpt with us. Hey, Angela.
Hi, guys.
All right, so tell us a little bit more about this question. Did it come up in response to the COVID-19 pandemic?
It actually didn't. This question came to us from Jamie McKenzie. She lives in Waterbury, and she asked it last summer, so very much pre-pandemic. And at the time, she was thinking about it more in terms of the climate crisis and what that would do to food supply. But of course, it's taken on new urgency during this COVID-19 health crisis. And Jamie has experienced something I think a lot of us have, which is sort of seeing photos of or in person experiencing empty shelves at the grocery stores, which is just a really unsettling experience.
Yeah. And as you show in this episode, Angela, it's not just grocery stores that are seeing this increase in demand. What are some of the other ways that Vermonters are trying to get food right now?
Yeah. So, for example, home delivery is definitely an enticing option right now if you can arrange it. The Intervale Food Hub in Burlington, even before this, they did offer home drop off. They have a box truck that they use to make the rounds and drop off food for members. And in a single week in mid-April, they saw their demand quadruple. It was such an intense spike that in order to sort of keep their own staff safe and keep up the quality of their service, they made the tough decision to just stop accepting new members until the summer. So that's one example. Also, interestingly, the Vermont Food Bank partnered with the Vermont National Guard in April to start offering giveaways of MREs, meals ready to eat, those sort of military-style food rations at what are called points of distribution around the state. You know, they set up at airports and so forth. The very first one they held was in Swanton, and they had something like 24,000 MREs to give away that day, and they're gone in a matter of hours. So really, no matter what your circumstance is right now, it's just strange or hard to get food. And it's something I think many people are not used to.
All right. Angela, thanks for sharing some of your reporting with us. And as you were just saying, there's a lot of demand in Vermont for food. And so now we're going to hear a little bit about whether or not Vermont farms would actually be able to meet that demand.
To find out how much local food we normally consume, I called up Ellen Kaler.
She's the executive director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund.
And we administer the Vermont Farm to Plate program.
Kaler says that of all the money Vermonters spend on food and drink, about 14% is on local products.
So just 14%. That means that an awful lot of the rest of what we eat comes from, it could be coming from New England, it could be coming from the United States or Mexico or China.
And of course, the bulk of what we do produce here, well, it's produced by cows.
The vast majority of what we produce in the state from just straight up agricultural products is dairy, and most of that gets exported out of the state.
Then there's our maple syrup,
pumpkins,
fruits, veggies,
a lot of livestock, but none of that is at the level of consumption to feed our entire population.
Though in this particular moment, demand for local food is spiking. From Brattleboro,
it's the busiest that we have ever been. Our business tripled in the last 6 weeks.
To Shoreham.
The demand, especially since March, has really soared.
To Craftsbury.
We had to hustle to keep up with it, and now we're kind of getting short on stored crops that we had from last fall.
That was Ashlyn Bristol of Rebop Farm, Will Stevens of Golden Russet Farm, and Pete Johnson of Pete's Greens. For Pete's Greens, retail sales have more than made up for the lost restaurant accounts. Meanwhile, in Rutland,
we have a lot of new business, actually, just different kinds.
Abby Thomas is the fifth generation owner of Thomas Dairy. Recently, they've discovered a whole new local market, schools that are sending lunches home to students.
We're able to provide them with, you know, a bulk delivery of quarts, half gallons, and gallons for their lunch program.
What these operations have in common is that they're direct to consumer, or close to consumer. A lot of farms that rely on restaurants or more complicated distribution are having a tougher time right now. So maybe they have the food, but no way to get it to their customers. And everyone is trying to stay healthy, which isn't easy if you're, say, a migrant farm worker living in shared housing.
Agriculture was in a bit of trouble before this pandemic, and this has not helped them at all. I'm very concerned about the farmers themselves. I'm concerned about our food supply.
That was Governor Phil Scott at a recent press conference. We've prepared for some kinds of emergencies, says Ellen Kaler of the Sustainable Jobs Fund, but not this kind.
Our state's done an amazing job since Tropical Storm Irene in preparing for things like flooding. Unfortunately, we haven't really thought about what would it look like if we actually prepared for food security, if we were going to not be able to bring any food into the state for several months, for instance.
This brings us back to Jamie's question. Could Vermont farms feed our whole population? As with so many questions, it depends whom you ask.
Well, it's a great question, and it's super interesting. I was doing some figuring this morning, and
my favorite answer came from Pete Johnson of Pete's Greens.
The short answer is yes.
If we're just talking straight calories to survive, like 3,000 a person per day,
it would only take 50,000 acres of potatoes to provide all the calories for the whole state of Vermont for the whole year. And that's about a tenth of our total agricultural land.
Or, if you don't like potatoes,
corn is almost as good. Wheat is harder. Wheat, you need almost four times the acreage. I did kale just for the heck of it. It performs pretty well. 120,000 acres, which is a little over a quarter of Vermont's ag land, in kale provides all the calories for everybody.
Pete Johnson knows these are extreme hypotheticals, but he's not exactly joking.
What you could do is take a diversified diet and just plug in certain amounts of all these things. And from this rough math I'm doing, I think you could definitely do it and have not a Spartan diet, but a good diet.
So that's one answer. Here's another.
No.
Again, Ellen Kaler.
A lot of the food that we eat in Vermont can't be produced year-round at the quantities that we need to be able to consume to feed the population. And I think a lot of us wouldn't be happy with not being able to eat bananas and chocolate and drink coffee and have oranges all year round.
For Kaler, it's not a matter of what we could eat. It's a matter of what we want to eat. We're used to certain luxuries and also staples like pasta and rice.
Of the things that we could produce year-round, it's primarily things like greens And so do we want to eat lettuce all year, basically live on lettuce all year? I don't think that's actually nutritionally possible.
Between these two unequivocal answers, I heard a lot of qualified yeses in my reporting. Yes, we could feed ourselves more than just potatoes and kale, but we'd need to value our ag land differently, value our farmers more. Yes, but we need to change the way we eat, be willing to pay for the true cost of food. And that brings us to the giant caveat of food accessibility.
And to hear more about how access to food factors into this question, check out the full episode. You can find Brave Little State wherever you get your podcasts.
When the coronavirus forced high schools to close in March, teachers had just a few days to figure out how to finish the year online.
They needed to ensure their students would stay on track academically and emotionally. And that's a job some high school teachers say has been draining, frustrating, and nearly impossible to do well from home. Reporter Nina Keck has more.
A few weeks ago, a high school teacher told me that someone asked her if now that schools were closed, she was enjoying her extended summer vacation. She told me she wanted to scream.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty intense.
Jenny Gartner teaches history at Rutland High School.
If you think about how much you work normally on a daily basis when you're in the building, it's so much more now, so much more. For people to think that, like, I'm not doing something or I'm not doing my job, it's so hurtful.
I asked Gartner and several other high school teachers to describe what it's been like for them working from home.
I have to say, even before they closed, I was already, and excuse me for just a moment, my cat jumped onto the desk and her bell loves to jingle right in the microphone, so I'm going to remove her and then continue to talk to you. Excuse me.
This is Leonard Bartenstein. He teaches English and religion at Mount St. Joseph's Academy, a Catholic high school in Rutland.
It's difficult to, you know, be sitting in my bedroom all alone talking to a screen all day and, you know, call this the same thing as teaching in a classroom.
Bartenstein remembers the Friday afternoon he learned his school was closing and he'd have to teach remotely. His American literature students were halfway through a book, which they'd been writing about and discussing each day in class.
I had to think about, well, how am I going to do that? This class has 26 students in it. Am I going to have them all on some sort of conference call? Am I going to have them emailing one another or doing some sort of discussion board forum posting? By Monday, we came together as a staff and we talked about how we would be doing a full schedule every day via Google Meets.
A lot of schools are using Google Meet for online video conferencing. For those of you who've experienced a Zoom meeting, it's similar. Everyone in class gets a small square on the screen, and cameras and microphones can be turned on or off. But who can see what varies from school to school. At Mount St. Joseph's Academy and Rutland High School, using the video link is optional. Bartenstein uses his camera so students can see his face in his upstairs spare room. And Jenny Gartner's students can see her in her kitchen where her computer is set up. But they said most of their students choose not to be on camera.
Right. So it's just a screen with their icon, like whatever their Google icon is for their Gmail account, and their name. So when we have class meetups, I do actually say, like, okay, so let's have a discussion. You know, Carrie, you go first. What do you think about this? Or John, what do you think about this? And we've actually had some pretty good discussions that way, but I don't ever see their faces.
It works, but it's awkward. And both teachers admit it takes much of the joy out of class time.
Okay, I'm recording.
This is Ben Cron. He teaches English at Middlebury Union High School.
For me, the hardest thing about teaching online has been trying to be at peace with not duplicating the classroom experience.
Cron says that while he is assigning work, and students are for the most part completing those tasks,
it's really hard to get a gauge on how much learning is really going on. That's another really difficult part, is just trying to make sure that our students are going to be at a place in the fall that we really want them to be.
The other big hurdle, doing it from home. Cron and his wife have 3 kids.
We have an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 1-year-old. And so from 8 to 9 while I'm working, I tend to work in our
They set up an office in their attic that all of them, well, not the 1-year-old, but everyone else takes turn using.
And at 9 o'clock, my 8-year-old will come up into the office and he has a Google Meet classroom meeting.
Cron oversees that while his wife watches the other two kids.
At 9:30, my 6-year-old will come up and she has her class Google class meeting.
At 10 a.m., his wife takes over the office to get her work done.
I'll try to manage the Google Classroom for my 8-year-old and 6-year-old while hanging out with my 1-year-old as well.
Somewhere in there, Ben Cron teaches 5 classes, corrects homework, and stays in email contact with students, parents, and colleagues.
So that's been one of the major struggles that I think every single parent who is at home right now can identify with. Sammy, I'm just finishing up the interview, okay, baby? What's wrong?
How do you spell recently?
Oh, R-E-C-E-N-T-L-Y. Yeah. Got it? Sorry.
Jenny Gartner says she feels grateful to have a job when so many people are being laid off. But workdays are long, distractions are many, and it's frustrating.
The hardest thing I'm doing right now is trying to figure out a way to be a good mom and be a good teacher. And right now, teaching is definitely winning.
Gartner, Bartenstein, and Cron all love what they do. They just don't love it now.
It's just been really hard to just get the energy and the gusto to wake up every day and do this over and over again, knowing that what we all want is what we had.
Cron says he's proud of how resilient his students are.
But for a lot of students, this is a platform that just doesn't work for a variety of reasons, and so I'm worried about some of them.
Jenny Gartner says for many of her students, school is their safe place, and not being able to check in with those kids and really see them on a daily basis gnaws at her.
You know, I have students living in motels, as we all do in Vermont, certainly, but some who are newly living in motels due to the economic crisis.
So now her biggest worry is what kind of trauma those kids are enduring and how hard will it be for teachers to get them back on track once classrooms are reopened. For VPR News, I'm Nina Kack.
The Eye on the Sky forecast today, clearing this morning, then clouds increasing late in the day, a chance of an afternoon rain or mountain snow shower, and highs in the 40s to lower 50s.
Thanks for listening to The Frequency Today. This episode featured reporting from Nina Kack, Angela Evansy, Liam Elder Connors, and John Dillon. And we'd love to hear your feedback for us. You can email the show. That's thefrequency@vpr.org. Our music is by Blue Dot Sessions, and our executive producer is Mark Davis. I'm Henry Epp.
And I'm Liam Elder Connors. Talk to you later.
Oh, I didn't do one of my patented goofs.
We have to do it again.